All right, so we are now on chapter 14, and in the additional materials, there's a little three-paragraph thing called Romans 14 Summary, which was written some time ago, and I have had to revise it since then, since it was written a long time ago. You can take a look at that just for a quick overview of what's going to happen in chapter 14, but now we'll do a verse by verse, and I think you're going to find that the questions that we raised yesterday about who is the audience really make a huge difference to how we understand chapter 14, just like it made a huge difference of how we understand chapter 13. So I want to start off with something that I wrote, and I wish I could tell you the date, but anyway, I can't tell you the date. I can't tell you the year. I can tell you that it was written for November 23rd of some year, and you can find it on the website under Who is weak? Or you can look under Romans 14:1 and it'll come up on my website. But I want to read this because it's about Nanos's argument that the audience of Paul in these chapters, 13, 14, 15, 16, is not what we usually expect when we read it from a church perspective. So here's what he says. If I called you weak in faith in Rome in the first century, who would you be? That's a rather odd question, but it's crucial to understand what Paul's actually saying. The Greek word "astheno," weak, could mean sick or impotent or feeble, but it also means powerless and without strength, the literal meaning, okay? The question is, who does Paul consider powerless and without strength? Everything about Romans depends on the answer, and there's four possibilities. The weak are Jewish messianic believers, Gentile messianic believers, Jews who do not believe Yeshua is the Messiah, or Gentiles who have no relationship to the faith. Those are the four possibilities. Following Luther, who followed some of the early church fathers, most Christian theologians have chosen number one. That is, they assume that Paul is writing to Jewish messianic believers, what they call Christians, okay? With this assumption, it appears as though Paul is instructing Gentile messianic believers to be tolerant of their Jewish brothers and sisters, leading them toward a stronger faith, which will allow them to put away their Jewish customs like Shabbat and diet, kosher diet. Okay? According to this interpretation, weak in faith means that they, quote, fail to trust God completely and without qualification. That's from J.D. Dunn, who's a very famous Christian theologian. Because they still believe that they need to live Torah-obedient lives rather than lives free from the law. That's the way the Christian community, since Chrysostom, and certainly following Luther, has understood this. Okay? So, here's the quote. When these interpreters of Romans assume that Paul is speaking of the weak as Christians, they inescapably stumble into the concomitant assumption that their weakness is evidence of lack of maturity to believe in God free from pre-Christian encumbrances of Torah and Jewish customs. So if I start with Luther, this chapter is about Paul saying, you know, those poor Jews, they're still weak in their faith because they haven't let go of Torah. That's how I would interpret it as a Lutheran, right? But this view, says Nanos, flies in the face of everything Paul says about Torah. In fact, it flies in the face of Paul's instructions to the strong not to judge the weak. For the very fact that the weak could be viewed as less mature is precisely the judgment Paul exhorts his readers to avoid. Something is drastically wrong with this assumption. Mark Nanos convincingly argues that the weak in Romans are not believers in the Messiah. They are those Jews who have not yet embraced the truth about Yeshua. They are the Torah observant, which is why they maintain dietary laws in the Shabbat, but they have not yet been convinced that Yeshua is God's anointed. Therefore, Paul instructs Jewish messianic believers, the strong, to live in such a way that they cause no offense to their as yet unconvinced Jewish brothers and sisters. In other words, while it is possible that Gentile believers in the Messiah could claim that they don't have to live according to Torah because they're not Jews, right? Paul tells them to do so anyway, because when they do, they will demonstrate the humility necessary to convince their Jewish colleagues that they really have embraced Yeshua as the Messiah and that they really are part of the people of God. This is Luther and most Christian believers turned upside down. Paul is telling us to live according to Jewish practices in order that the Jews might be convinced that our sincerity in the faith and recognize Yeshua as the Messiah. Everything we know about Paul and his view of Torah confirms that Nanos is correct. We have it backwards. We are trying to convince the Jews to become Christians by living in a way that denies everything that they know about God and his Torah. We think Jews need to be converted to Christianity. We brought Luther's line all the way, right? But Paul is arguing just the opposite. Why wouldn't he? He is a Torah observant Jew who desperately wants his Jewish brothers to see who Yeshua is, the Jewish Messiah. So Paul asks Gentiles to live like Jews in order to make sure that the Jewish brothers see the truth. Now we can understand why Paul says, do not destroy with your food him whom Christ, for whom Christ died, Romans 5:15. In other words, practice the dietary regulations of Torah so that your not yet convinced Jewish brothers will not reject your claims about Yeshua. The strong, those who know Yeshua is the Messiah, are responsible for the deliverance of the weak, those who have yet to accept Yeshua as the Messiah. By the way that they will live. Is pork tenderloin worth driving a man or woman away from the Lord? Okay. So now that we know that the audience should be, you know, look, Paul is writing so that the Gentile Christians will not claim that they're free from Torah obedience, even if they think that they are because they're not Jewish, that they should live according to the customs and the expectations and norms of the community that they're joining. Okay? So that reverses everything that the church normally thinks about chapter 14. So now we're going to look at the verses one at a time and see what happens in this upside down appreciation of the verse. Okay? So let's start with number one. Now, except the one who is weak in faith, but not for the purpose of passing judgment on his opinions. Okay, so this is interesting because, of course, but not for is not in the Greek text. It's added by the NASB. I'm going to read you what Uriel says in a minute. But let's take a look at the actual words. Asthenio is the verb to be weak. And the Christian view is, and I quote from the theological word book of the New Testament, or the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, a weakness can be something that must be overcome, as in the case of weak in faith. He cites Romans 14:1 and 1 Corinthians 8:9, who are certainly to be protected by the strong. The terms are perhaps a party slogan, but who are still deficient in knowledge, not having fully freed themselves from the pre-Christian past. So here's a theological lexicon that's used widely by the Christian church and scholars that claims that this, it's introducing a theological idea into the definition of the word, claiming that weak means that you still haven't converted to Christianity when you no longer need the law. Okay? But now let's look at what Paul says. Now, except the one who is weak in faith. And if Paul means the one who has yet to come to terms with Yeshua as the Messiah, then he's not speaking to the weak as the Christians. He's speaking to the weak as the Jews who still need, as far as he's concerned, to accept Yeshua as the Messiah, right? And so his emphasis is on you Gentiles, the strong, who understand Yeshua as the Messiah, you need to live in a way that shows that you are completely compliant with the expectations of the Jewish community. Okay, so we know what the word faith is, pistis, right? It's a dative, which means that the faith is a trusting action as the object of a verb, direct object of a verb. And now look what he says. But for the purpose of, and my NASB says passing judgment, but what it really means is to accept. And here I want to read you the little text. Our translation, which says now accept, but in the Greek it's quite strong, it's much stronger. The verb is proslambano, literally to take toward, that is, to deliberately act in such a way that these people are carried into your circle. This verb is usually translated welcome. What is the difference between accept and welcome? If you reflect for a moment on your own experience, you will probably recognize that being accepted is not quite the same as being welcomed. Acceptance often implies tolerance. Welcome is much more inclusive. Accepting you sometimes mean, accepting you sometimes mean that I consider myself superior and allow you into my circle in spite of your inferiority. But welcome means that I need you and I'm glad that you have arrived. I suggest to you that Paul is of this opinion. Those who are weak in faith are essential to the group, right? They are to be sought after and welcomed because without them, we become arrogant. So what he's saying to the Gentile messianic believers is that you need to be completely embracing of the Orthodox community. Don't act as though you have the truth and they're somehow inferior to you. Open your arms and welcome them in every possible way. And how are you going to do that? You're going to live a completely Torah obedient life so that there's no argument that they can raise that says, oh my gosh, you see, you're not really one like us. In other words, become completely what they expect a Torah observant Jew would be, an Orthodox Jew, in order to show them that your reliance on the Messiah does not change their expectations about how God interacts with Israel. Okay? And look what he says, of passing judgment over their opinions. And the actual text reads, not to quarrel over their opinions. What would be the point of welcoming someone if you just have a verbal sparring partner, right? That isn't welcoming. So Paul is really, really pushing the Gentile believers to change their attitude about how they see themselves in the community. What he's really saying is, you're the ones who need to reach out, to act in such a way that no one will have any objection to your behavior in the community, and therefore you gain the right to talk about Yeshua the Messiah. Okay? So let's look at the next. Now, with that in mind, everything about what he says from this point on is going to change. Okay? So, verse 2. One man has faith that he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats vegetables only. Okay, so who's the weak person in Paul's mind? He's the one who is kosher, right? The Gentile comes into the community thinking that he can eat whatever he wants. After all, he's not Jewish, so why should he have to follow Jewish laws? And what does Paul say? No, mistake. If you do that, you will offend the Orthodox Jew, and he will then take that to mean that your claim about the Messiah can't be the God of Israel because you are offending him in your diet. So you, the non-Orthodox Gentile believer in the Messiah, must act more, you must have a kosher attitude that's more stringent than even the Orthodox, right? Okay, so.
So, Skip, in that number two, the weak is the Orthodox kosher Jew, right?
Yeah, because remember, weak does not mean for Paul powerless, insufficient, inferior. What does it mean? It means the person who has yet not accepted Yeshua as the Messiah. That's all it means. The strong for Paul is the one who's embraced the truth of the Messiah. The weak is the one who has not yet embraced. But the important word there is yet, because what does Paul look, remember the pattern. Paul in 9, 10, 11, what is he concerned about? In 9, 10, 11, what's he concerned about? His fellow Jews becoming Messiah aware. Okay? His whole argument in 9, 10, 11 is all about, oh my gosh, my heart is broken over the fact that my own people don't see this truth. Okay? So 12, 13, 14, 15 cannot be a complete change in the direction that he's going, because his argument all along has been, you need to do everything possible to allow the community to recognize how willing you are to embrace their norms and their traditions in order to witness for the truth of the Messiah. So from Paul's perspective, the person who is lacking is the one who doesn't believe in Yeshua, not the one who does. Okay? So that means what Paul is instructing the Gentile believers in the Messiah to do is to live absolutely obedient Torah lives, right? Because that will create the witness that he needs for the Torah observant community to recognize that these people, not only do they live exactly like us, not only do they embrace all of our tradition and rules, but they also have this experience with the Messiah. Oh, how can that be possible if the Messiah is not a kosher Torah observant Jew, right? I mean, you can see Paul's argument.
So Paul believes the strong in that situation are the Gentile Messianic believers coming into the faith, but he's never talking about the Jewish Messianic believers that are already both Torah observant and believers in Yeshua, and he's not talking about the pagans, but Christianity believes in this situation that the weak is the Jewish Orthodox. I mean,
Here's what Christianity believes. Christianity believes that the weak are the Gentile believers in the Messiah who still hang on to Torah. So Christianity's view is their weakness is that they're still trying to live Torah obedient lives. If they just let go of the Torah obedience, then they'll be strong in the faith, which means that they'll stop being Jewish.
Okay, so Christianity believes the Jewish Messianic believers are the weak that he's talking about.
But remember, Christianity doesn't believe that they're Jewish Messianic believers. Christianity believes that they're Christians, which means they've left Judaism. Okay, and so it reads these verses as though, hey, look, you're weak because you're still trying to be Jewish when you're really Christian. So Paul's argument from the church's perspective is stop trying to be Jewish.
Okay, so the Christians have it wrong. So Paul's not talking about the Jewish Messianic believers at all. The Christians have it completely wrong.
He's talking about Gentiles who normally would not be allowed into the synagogue, who have come into the synagogue on the basis of their relationship to Yeshua. And what he's saying is, listen, you came from an environment where there was no such thing as kosher, where you didn't have to worry about Shabbat, where you didn't have all those rituals, regulations, and traditions, where you didn't celebrate the feast. Now you've come into that synagogue. Are you going to say, okay, well, look, I have a relationship with the Messiah. I don't need all of that stuff. Paul's saying, no, that's the wrong attitude. Your attitude should be, how can I witness to these people that my Messiah is as Jewish as you could ever get? And the only way that you can do that is to live a life that's completely Orthodox while you embrace the idea of Yeshua as the Messiah. So that the Jewish Orthodox community that has not yet accepted Yeshua as the Messiah has nothing to hold against you. That's Paul's argument, right? That you need to live in a way so that there's nothing that prevents them from recognizing that your belief in Yeshua as the Messiah is completely Orthodox.
I have a hard time understanding how the Jewish Messianic believers, or Christians as you call them, and the Jewish Orthodox believers and the Gentile believers coming in, how they all prayed together.
But that's Paul's concern, exactly. What he's saying is, look, we know from Galatians, here's what we know from Galatians. The Gentiles who came into the Galatian synagogue, right, in Galatia, there were Gentiles in the synagogue, right? The argument in Galatians is that the Jews who were part of the synagogue did not accept them into full membership because they weren't acting Jewishly, okay? And Paul's argument is, no. They have the right of full membership because they're coming in under God's call through the Messiah. Now, once they're in the synagogue, you need to teach them the norms and behaviors of what it means to be Jewish. You can't expect them to have that ahead of time because they came on the basis of the call. They didn't come on the basis of being proselytized, okay? But now they're there. So don't tell them that you're not really a member. You know, you can attend, but you're not really a member. No, that doesn't work, says Paul, because they came on the basis of a calling. The Jewish Orthodox community is responsible for teaching them what it means to live a Torah observant life. Now you put the same thing in Romans. Paul's talking to the Gentile believers who have already come into the synagogue, and he's saying, listen, You can't be part of this assembly and make any headway at all when it comes to Yeshua if you're acting like Gentiles, right? You may think that you have the right to be there because you're accepting the call of Yeshua, but the only reason that you're going to have status in the community is if you act in such a way that they have nothing to hold against you. And that means you have to be fully, completely Torah observant so that there was nothing that stands in the way between you and your witness of Yeshua as the Messiah.
So the Jewish Messianic believers that do both already, that follow the Torah and believe in Yeshua, they're good. They're example.
They're good to go. They're Paul, right? They're good to go. He isn't talking to them. He doesn't have to talk to them because they're doing exactly what he wants. The people that he's writing to are the Gentiles who come into the assembly thinking that they don't have to be Jewish because, after all, they believe in the Messiah, right?
There must have
and
been conflict.
Ethnically, they're not Jews. So why would I have to live according to all those things that are only for the Jews? And Paul's saying, no, that's not the case. You belong to the assembly. Therefore, you need to live according to the traditions and expectations of the assembly.
So he must have known that there was conflict going on between the Jewish Messianic believers were probably telling the Gentiles that, look, you're not going to get our brothers who are Orthodox and haven't accepted Yeshua yet to follow. We can't change them if you're coming in and saying we don't have to do anything. We just need to be believers and that's it.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Paul, maybe Paul didn't know that was happening in Rome, but he certainly knew it was happening in Thessalonica, in Galatia, in Ephesus, because he'd been dealing with this for 20 years. Right? Okay. So he's anticipating this is the same thing is happening in Rome. Now, what's really interesting is Chrysostom, Tertullian, all these guys turned the argument completely upside down. So you can see that if you treat the audience that Paul's writing to as the Christians, the previously Jewish converted people, you can see that the argument completely flips upside down. And Paul's saying, look, your problem is that you're still trying to hang on to Torah. Get rid of Torah and you'll be fine, right?
Yeah,
exactly what the church has argued for 1800 years. Right?
Well, that's why Romans is so confusing because he looks like a hypocrite. He looks like on one hand, he tells them to do this and on the other hand, he tells them not. It makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, but it's only confusing and looks hypocritical if you don't understand, as I said, the very first sentence, right? The audience, the most important thing is who is he writing to? Who's the audience? Okay? So let's continue and see how he develops this, okay? So
just a quick question, Skip, please.
Yes.
David. Yeah, in Stern's version there, he's talking about the ones who think they're strong can eat anything, and the ones whose trust is weak eat only vegetables. Is that just an example? They weren't vegetarians.
Yeah, it's just an example. It doesn't mean that they're vegetarian. It means that the ones who are strong, right, the Gentiles who are coming in, who have this relationship with the Messiah, Paul's saying, hey, look, you think you don't have to pay attention to kosher. The ones who are weak, that is the ones who have not yet accepted the Messiah, they're kosher. So he says to you, what's your problem? You would sacrifice the relationship that you have with these people over food? Come on, get with it.
No, that's fine. I understand. I just wasn't sure about the word vegetables, if that was something added in or changed or.
No, it's not added in. It's just his example is, okay, be kosher. Right?
Great.
And remember in the first century how the issue about meat was so important because some meat that was in the marketplace that you could buy was previously gifted to pagan deities, right? And then sold in the market. So there's this big issue about can I even buy that meat? Can I eat that meat? How do I know that it wasn't already given as a pagan offering, right? So he uses vegetables because nobody in their right mind is worried about vegetables, right? Okay. So let's go to number three.
Yep.
Let him who eats
regard. Skip. Sorry. Yes. Tom is trying to get your attention.
I'm sorry.
Pam, okay. Yes, Pam, go ahead.
When we try to explain this to new people in our fellowship, we explain it as being adopted. And when you're fully grown and you already have habits and you are adopted into a new household, you have to learn the house rules to be able to coexist. And so we try to put it that way. And the Torah to us is the house rules. This is how you behave in God's house.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. And every family has their own little traditions and things that they do. It's, I mean, there's nothing abnormal about this at all.
No, that's right. The only abnormal thing is that the church read it upside down. The church read it as though the house rules were invented by Luther, right? Not by God. And so that if you're going to be a real Christian, you need to leave the Jewish rules behind. And Paul's arguing exactly the opposite. If you want to really make a statement for Yeshua, you need to be completely Orthodox, right? Okay. So let's see how he develops this, because he's going to talk about several different important issues that determine how you behave in the community. Okay, number three, let not him who eats regard with contempt him who does not eat. Okay, so now turn it upside down. What is he saying? Let him who does not eat, or sorry, let not him who eats, that is the Gentile Christian, the Gentile, quote unquote, Christian, the Gentile Messianic believer who comes into the synagogue and who in his previous experience has been able to eat anything. He's Roman, right? I mean, come on, you can eat anything you want in Rome, right? So when that person comes in and says, look, I have a relationship with Yeshua. I still believe in the God of Israel. Why should I have to change my diet? Paul says, no. Stop acting as though you have the right to judge what's happening in the norms in the community, right? Look what he says, right? Let not him who does not eat judge him who does, right? In other words, stop making these points a point of contention, right? So three, regard with contempt is to despise someone or something on the basis of what is worthless and of no value. So Paul's saying, look, your idea that you have a relationship with Yeshua, therefore you belong to this community regardless of your behavior, that's a worthless idea. That doesn't have any value because you're, as Pam says, you're entering into an adopted role in the house and you need to accept the house rules. Okay. So for God has accepted him is proslambano, has received. He's received. So who is it that God's received? I mean, look at the verse, right? So he says, don't judge, let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has accepted him. Okay, now who's he talking about? Let him who does not eat, right? That's the Jewish Orthodox community, right? They have kosher diet. They don't eat everything. And so Paul says, okay, here come these Gentile Messianic believers, and they are trying to be kosher, and don't you pass a judgment upon them because when they came into the community, they didn't have a kosher diet, right? Why? Because God's accepted them. They're part of the community because they have a relationship with Yod-Heh-Vah through the Messiah. So on both sides, no judgment.
Oh, so he's basically saying you both have to accept each other and not have judgment on the other. But even though he's saying that, he still wants the Gentiles coming in that believe
to be Orthodox,
still follow the customs of the Jews, even though he's saying, he's not saying to them, don't judge each other and do whatever you each want to do. But okay. So it's a little confusing
because look, here's Paul's situation, right? He's dealing with the congregation where Gentiles are coming into the assembly from a very, very different paradigm and very different background. And what he's saying to the Orthodox community in this verse is, look, don't start passing judgment upon these people because they come from such a different background. Let them have time to absorb what the norm is, what the house rules are for being part of the assembly. So don't start off by saying, hey, you're not kosher, therefore I'm not going to listen to you, right? Let them become what they intend to be under God, right? And give them space to grow into the community, right? Cindy, what does Stern say?
I was just going to say, with all of this, Stern, with all the let not him, all it puts it a little bit, I think, more succinct. The one who eats anything must not look down upon the one who abstains, and the abstainer must not pass judgment on the one who eats anything, because God has accepted him.
Yeah.
So it's like, so you're saying the same thing, but the words just come a little bit.
Exactly.
So in other words, don't slam each other. Teach and learn to respect the community that you are coming into.
Right.
And the people who are you are coming into need to understand to teach them what's the rules.
Right. So I think Stern is right that the word should be abstain, not eat, because not eat looks like, okay, well, we have nothing to do it. But abstain means that there's a kosher diet and they abstain from some foods because they're not authorized by God. Okay. And what Paul is saying on the behalf of the Gentiles is, hey, start living according to the norms of the community. And what he's saying to the Orthodox is, don't judge those people because they come into the community with a very different background. Give them time to absorb the rules of the community. Okay? Don't, in other words, what he's saying is, you don't have the right to judge any of them because God's accepted everybody. Everybody's in the community is there because God's accepted them. So now give them space to grow into the community. Okay?
And teach them. I mean, the Orthodox, they have to be taught. So go ahead, Larry.
Sure. Okay, let's continue.
Let me interject something.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
What you're saying is it seems to be in complete alignment with Acts 15, 19 through 21.
Yeah.
Agreed. Right.
Exactly, because what happens in Acts is the Gentiles are coming into the community, right? The argument is, okay, how in the world, what do we do with all these people that are coming in the community? They're not Jewish. They don't have the tradition. They don't have the background. They haven't been proselytized, right? And what is Paul's argument? That God's called them, so let them in. And what do James and Peter decide? Okay, there's only four things that they have to stop doing. And every single one of those is a pagan practice. If you read it like the church reads it, they read it like, if you don't do these four things, then, you know, you're good. So we don't have to worry about Torah because those things you're not doing. That's not what Paul means. What Paul means is, you can't be practicing pagan rituals and be part of the synagogue community. These four things you have to let go of. And then what does he say? Because every week Moses is taught. So every week they're going to learn what it means to be part of this community. Right? Pam, you had something?
I think this is, can you hear me? I think this is probably the best definition of grace or explanation of grace that I've ever heard. Be gracious to one another as you grow into your faith.
Yeah.
Regardless of where you come from. And it reminds me of when God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and they were totally pagan and he was gracious to them.
Yep.
While they muddled through and tried to enter into the house and become part of the household.
Yeah. 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 You're absolutely right. So this is really important for us. Because here's the problem. If we're part of a Christian community, the Christian community views a messianic believer who tries to be Orthodox as weak, right? Because they think, oh my gosh, you haven't become fully Christian because you're still trying to live under the law. And what we have to show to the Christian community is our faith through the Yeshua as the Jewish Messiah is so vibrant, so vital, so incredibly filled with charity, love, tolerance, that there's nothing that they can argue against to say, you see, if you really believed in God, this is how you would behave. Because then they can't say, oh my gosh, your Torah observance stands in the way of you being the kind of believer that God wants, because everything about your life will be based on God's will. Right? So now you have a standing in that community to demonstrate why you think Yeshua as the Jewish Messiah asks you to be Torah observant. It's exactly the same in the Jewish community, because in the Jewish community, you come as a complete outsider, right? You're not Jewish. You're from a Gentile background. You don't have the traditions, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you behave? You behave in a way that shows them that you're fully Torah observant. And then they're saying, But how can that be? You didn't come in because you converted. You came in because of this claim that you have about Yeshua. And the more observant you are, the stronger your claim about Yeshua gets. Because Paul, in both cases, Paul is saying, don't put up any, he's going to use these words later on. Don't put up any obstacle or any stumbling block that's going to cause you to offend the other person so that they won't hear the truth of the of Yeshua. Right? That's his entire argument. Yes, Benita.
The problem is that today the Christians, when we say Jesus Yeshua is Messiah, that the issue is that we believe that Jesus is the Savior, is God. He's not the Son of God, but he's God. So that's where the big problem comes in. And the that's what I'm fighting with in my head right now to try to explain that, because I got kicked off of prayer walls because we were praying for Israel and the Jews. And it's like I was trying to let them know Jesus is not God. He's the Son of God. So then I got kicked off. But that's the big issue right there, because when we say Jesus the Messiah, that's it. He's God. He's not the Son of God. So that's where there's a big clash and issue. And I want to give up.
The defining theological issue for the Christian church is the Trinity, right? So look, I've been plenty attacked over my view of the Trinity, okay? So what is my response? And the response is never to try to convince someone theologically that that's a mistake. My response to that line of argument is always, let's go look at the history. And if I can get people to start to understand the history of how that doctrine came about, which most people have no idea, right? If they start looking at the history of the doctrine, if they realize that the early church fathers didn't even believe it, that Athanasius and Arius had a 100-year battle over it. When that happens, okay, so the power just went out in my apartment. I'm on battery, so if I lose connection with you, just stay there, and I'll do my best to get back on. But now, to finish the statement about the Trinity, if I can get people to start looking at the history, then I have the opportunity to talk to them. Otherwise, if they only want what the church preaches in its doctrinal position, then I can't make any progress, because the doctrine is so embedded in church thinking that people who only listen to what the church tells them and don't investigate the history of where the idea came from will never move off of that position.
Very good. So now let's just say that I'm a Jew in the times of Acts, and Jesus came and he showed the way to the Father, and you know, miracles, signs and wonders, and just like wow.
How can I say this?
Because it's just troubling me. I'm trying to say it properly. And so this whole new concept comes in the equation of Jesus coming on earth, the Son of God. How do I convert from being a Torah observant? And then boom, Jesus comes in the picture. So what, he's not the Messiah, because for me as a Jew, I would say God is my Messiah. God is my Savior, not
okay,
Jesus.
Wait. First, I don't want to get on a sidetrack here, because I think we need to progress, right, through 14. But what I will tell you is that, yes, God, all the way through the Tanakh, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh claims to be the one who brings salvation. But the Messiah is his agent. And I would suggest that you take a look at Kendall. What's the name of the book? The God of Jesus. is the name of the book, and it takes you through the whole first century concept of agency and how important that is to understand what was really happening in the role of the Messiah. Okay? And it's a long piece, but it treats every single verse that has anything to do with messianic ideas, and it'll be, I think it'll be really, really helpful.
Thank you. I'll borrow it from Liz.
I know, Skip, you don't want to talk about this, and I'm not going to. I just want to say one thing for her. The Jews always expected a Messiah to come save them. Back from Egypt, they expected a Messiah to come save them. It's just that when Yeshua came, he didn't reflect who they thought he was supposed to be.
Yeah, and by the way, okay, and for that, just the last comments on this, right? Please look at Joseph Klausner's The Idea of the Messiah from Genesis to the End of the Talmudic Period. Very long but detailed analysis of how the Jewish concept of who the Messiah is and what he's supposed to do shifts over 2,000 years, okay? And then recognize that that change was brought about by social, political, and environmental factors that shaped the way the Jews understood what the Messiah was going to be like. And then you can read Abraham Cohen's Every Man's Talmud on the role of the Messiah. And he shows you what happens when the Jewish community starts thinking about all this.
Talmud on the
George, is that you? It's breaking up really bad, George.
What happens when the Jewish community starts... George, is that you?
Oh, I'm having all kinds of trouble here.
Okay.
I'm having.
Yeah, the sound is breaking up all over the place. So, look, I want to continue because my intention was to get through 14 today, which obviously it's not going to happen. Okay. But I want to continue because now we're into this thinking pattern that Paul's addressing the Gentile believers, right? Okay. So let's look and see what he says. I don't have any power yet, so we'll see what happens. Okay. So look what he says in verse 5. This is really interesting. One man regards one day above another. Another regards every day alike. Alike is added by the NASB. Each man must be fully convinced in his own mind. Okay, so now who's he addressing? If you think that he's addressing the people who regard every day as the correct ones, then you miss the point. Because what Paul's saying to the Gentile believers, hey, okay, so you came in from a religious environment where every day was in some way connected to a pagan god. Okay, all you got to do is go with me to Bali, and you'll see every single morning people coming out of their shops and doing altar services in front of the idol to make sure that that day works for them. Okay, so what's Paul saying? The people who regard one day are the Jewish Orthodox. Right? And he's saying, okay, so you Gentile believers who thought that you could just, you know, you could celebrate on any day, start acting as though you're Orthodox and regard the Sabbath as the most important day. It's exactly upside down from what the Christian church would have believed, right? Because Paul's not telling them every day is okay. He's saying, listen to what the Jewish Orthodox community is telling you about the Shabbat, and don't treat every day as if it's, you know, perfectly. You can worship God in a Shabbat service on Sunday or on Monday, on Tuesday, Wednesday, whenever you happen to feel like it. Paul's saying, no, that isn't the case. Okay. And then look at 6. He who observes that the day observes it to the Lord, and he who eats does so to the Lord, and he who gives thanks does so to God, and he who eats not, he also celebrates it to the Lord. So what Paul's saying is allow the community to grow. And stop making these points obstacles and stumbling blocks for each other, right? Learn how to allow enough tolerance for people to come on board and learn the process of being assimilated into the group, okay? Don't come into the assembly thinking that whatever you had in the past in Rome is still acceptable, except, of course, you don't go to the Temple of Zeus anymore, simply because you got called by the Messiah. That's not enough, says Paul. Because the purpose, remember, there's two things going on here. There's your status, which is a divinely appointed because you've responded to the call, and your purpose. And the purpose is, as far as Paul's concerned, to live in such a way that others will be attracted to the Messiah because of your testimony, because of your life testimony. Not what you say, but how you act. Okay?
Yeah, it's a little confusing just because he is saying to them, to both of them, you know, be tolerant of each other. But he's still saying to the Gentiles with faith in Yeshua to become Torah observant. So it's a little confusing.
Yeah. Look, you just have to keep telling yourself, okay, I need to read this upside down, because our Western training has been to read it as though Paul's writing to Christians and telling them, oh, you know, you understand the truth, and you just need the Orthodox people to come on board and become Christian. And that's exactly the opposite of what Paul's actually saying. What he's saying to the Gentile believers that the church calls Christians is that you need to become Jewish. It's exactly the opposite. Right.
Well, the Gentile believers aren't called Christians. The Jewish Messianic believers are called Christians. The Gentile believers are just coming in. They're not Christians yet.
No. The Gentile believers in the Messiah, as far as the church are concerned, are Christians. The Jewish believers in the Messiah are still not yet Christians because they're hanging on to Torah. Right? It takes 500 years for the church to get rid of the Jewish Messianic believers who were Torah observant. And there's a book called The Ways That Never Parted, which is a historical look at how long it took for the church and the Roman Empire to remove all of those people. My wife is going off to the opera and she looks fabulous. Okay, so the point is that over the course of half a millennia, the church eliminated all the communities that were still Jewish Orthodox, but believers in Yeshua, right? In order to replace them with people who believed in the Christian Messiah, the Son of God, and did not accept the Messianic code. It took a long time for them to get rid of them.
Well, they basically the church just basically didn't accept them anymore, and they basically died out.
Yeah, and they were persecuted, and they were exterminated, and everything else, because they didn't fit the Christian theology that you could not be Jewish, and you could not accept the God of Israel and still be Jewish, right? Because the Christians believed that the God of Israel had chosen the church as the new Israel, and therefore you didn't have to be Jewish anymore. And look, frankly, it makes perfect sense politically, right? If I'm going to claim that the Bible is my sacred text and the Bible is all about Israel, and I don't want to be Jewish, then I have to find a way to make Israel become something other than the people that God chose. And the church did that by claiming that they were the new Israel. So they still had the history of God, but now they didn't have any of the Judaism that went with it. And frankly, they had to do that. Because if the church, quote unchurch, had endorsed the Mosaic Code, what would they be? Jewish. They wouldn't be Christian. They'd still be Jewish because they'd be Torah observant and believing that Yeshua was the Jewish Messiah. And you can't have that and have a new religion. So you have to get rid of it.
And why did they not want to be Jewish? Just anti-Semitism?
Because the last thing that you wanted in order to have power in the religious world was to just submit yourself to a tradition of the Jews that had been going on for thousands of years. And politically, the Jews were under a lot of pressure. And so why would I want to affiliate with them and have Caesar come after me? And a whole bunch of other reasons, right? Read the book, The Ways That Never Parted, and you'll see all the historical stuff that was going on that caused that split after the Bar Kokhba revolt. Okay? So, please, let's continue. 7. Okay? Now, look what he says in 7. For not one of us lives for himself, and not one of us dies for himself. And then 8. For if we live, we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. And what's Paul's argument? You're all in the same boat, guys. Stop trying to differentiate between where one person is in their spiritual journey and where you are in the spiritual journey. Stop being the judge of somebody else's spiritual movement, because, quite frankly, you're all in the same boat. And look what this is, the important thing is that he flips, just like the argument, he flips the metaphor upside down, because what he says first is death and second life. Not, how do we say? We would normally say, oh, to live and die, right? But he says to die and live. So why does he do that? Because in his view, to die comes first, right? I have to die to the old way in order to live to the new way. So the metaphor has to be death, then life, not life, then death. Okay? Do you understand? It's the same argument that he's had all along, that the most important, we go all the way back to chapter 5, chapter 6, what, chapter 7, what matters? What matters is the symbolic death that occurs in baptism that situates you as a completely new person. And so what's important is death. You have to die first before you can come into this synagogue environment and live as a different person. You have to die to that old life. Okay? You can't sort of bring along a few things from New York when you move to Chicago, right? You got to stop being a New Yorker.
And in that respect, he's talking to the Gentiles coming in.
Yeah, of course. What he's saying is, you Gentiles, look, the Jews don't have to die in order to live. They already have a relationship with God. Who has to die in order to live? The Gentiles who are coming into the synagogue, right? They have to stop their lives, their previous lives, and come to life in a new environment with a new person. Okay? Okay, number 9. For this end, Christ died and lived. And look at the metaphors exactly backwards the way that we would say it. We would say Christ lived and died. But what does Paul say? Christ died and lived. Why? Because his point is that the life that matters is the life that happens after the death, not before, right? He's making the point that just as Christ died and rose again to a new relationship with men and with God, so you have to do the same thing. So he says, just as Christ died and lived again, that he might be the Lord both of the dead and the living. Okay, so there it is. He's the Lord of the dead, those people who have symbolically died with him, and of the living, those who have a relationship with God, right? Okay, 10. But you, why do you judge your brother? Or you again, why do you regard your brother with contempt? For we all stand before the judgment seat of God. Okay, so again, Paul's argument is, stop putting obstacles in other people's way. Right? You're responsible for yourself in front of God. So are they. So give them the tolerance that they need in order to grow into the faith. Okay? Now, I want to look at some of the things that Uriel says here, because there's a interesting changes in the way that he interprets this. Okay, so let's go back to the first verse, where Uriel says, now embrace the one who lacks the element of conviction. And for Uriel, he translates pistis, which we translate as faith, as conviction. And you're going to see that all the way through his translation. Who lacks the element of conviction in order to avoid bringing about disputes. Okay, no problem there. 2, on the one hand, one person considers that he can eat anything. That's the Gentile believer, right? But the one who lacks courage, and I don't think lacks courage is the right word, because the word for weak here should be the one who has yet to accept the Messiah, right? Paul doesn't, it might be that Paul thinks that they lack courage because they haven't been willing to stand up and say, yes, I believe Yeshua is the Messiah. But remember, the verb is to be weak, to be in some sense unserviceable, unusable, right? And what Paul means, of course, is that they haven't embrace the fullness of this message that God is sending through the Messiah. Okay, now look at what he says in 3. And one who consumes should not look down upon the one who doesn't. And so he's exactly right. The one who consumes, that is, the one who came in as a pagan and thinks that he can eat anything is not allowed to look down on the one who follows a kosher diet. Okay, now verse 4. Who are you to pronounce judgment upon a servant belonging to someone else? So who's the servant? The servant is the Orthodox Jew who belongs to God. Who are you, the Gentile who comes in through the Messiah? Who are you to judge the Orthodox Jew? Right? You don't have the right to say what that servant should do. That's entirely up to him and God. Before one's own master, one either stands or falls. And then in 5, some people differentiate a day with greater emphasis than a day. Okay? In other words, some people, that is the Orthodox Jews, consider the Sabbath the most important day. Right? Now, for one who sets apart every day, let each one be absolutely persuaded by his own decision factors. Okay? So what is he saying? In the pagan world, you had every day was a day that was related to a deity. In the Jewish world, the Shabbat is the most important day. So get on board with the Orthodox community. Stop acting as though you need to make a food sacrifice in front of the pagan idol every day. Right? Verse 6. For the one who is giving honorable respect to Hashem's day, be respectful. For the one who eats for Hashem, eat, but also be grateful to God. And for the one who abstains from eating, for Hashem, don't eat, but also be thankful to God. Now, 7, the fact remains, none of us lives for himself and no one dies for himself. So what is Paul saying in 7? And what is Uriel emphasizing? Leviticus 19:18, you are part of a community. Do not act as though you're independent of what the community thinks. You are intimately connected with everyone in the community. Act accordingly. Okay? You don't have the right to do whatever you want because you're an individual. That's a Roman idea. When you come into the Hebrew community, when you come into the Hebrew paradigm, you are intimately connected with everyone in the community. What you do affects everyone else. What everyone else does affects you. Stop thinking that you're not interdependent. Don't be the Greek philosophical independent individual, because in the Hebrew community, individuals don't count. What counts is the family, the community, the assembly. Okay? God deals with Israel as a whole. He doesn't deal with every single individual in Israel. Right? Of course, he has a relationship with all of them, but what matters is the whole of the assembly. Okay? And then he says, Earl's right on board there. And then on 8, while we are living, the truth that we are living is for Hashem. While we're dying for Hashem. Consequently, whether we live or die, whether we're living or dying, we're doing so for Hashem. Now, he treats that as a participle, living, dying, right? I think that it's more important to treat it as an aorist past, lit to die and live. And Uriel turns it around, right? He uses the common phrase that we would use, living and dying. But in fact, Paul, I think, is very deliberate that he changes the metaphor to upside down, dying and living. I think that's important to recognize, okay? Now let's go to 9. Reflecting upon this fact, Mashiach died so that over death and over the living, he should preside. Okay. So now the metaphor is in the right place. What matters to Paul, and what does he say over and over and over in his letters? I preach Messiah, the Messiah crucified, right? What matters to him is the death and the resurrection, right? In fact, you remember all the way back at the beginning of this entire letter, within the first few verses, he says that the reason Yeshua is the Messiah is because God validated his agent through the resurrection. So the most important thing for Paul is life after the death. And here he just says the same thing about you, that the most important thing, you Gentiles who have come into the assembly, the most important thing is you died and now you're alive. Okay.
And by so, the way, Skip, he doesn't look at the Jews as they have to die and then live because they already have a relationship with the God of Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. He's saying to the Gentiles, you are only alive in this community because you have a relationship with the Messiah. So be grateful for that and understand that the people that you're involved with have had living relationship with the God of Israel for as long as they've been alive and for centuries before that. So don't think of yourself as a person who's now been, you know, you've got some religious insight. Think of yourself as you were once alive, you died in the Messiah, and now you're a new person who has to learn life all over again. Okay? And then we're up
but
to
they
10.
Also had the Gentile believers also come in because of the God of Israel. I mean, it's not
yes,
just
course.
A Jesus cult here.
No, no. They came in because they recognized Yeshua as the Messiah, the fully authorized agent of the God of Israel, which attracted them into the synagogue community to begin with, because now they want to live in response to the God of Israel. And what Paul is saying is, okay, you're dead to your old life. You are only alive because you've entered into this community of the God of Israel. And by the way, he's already said that in the past, where he says, this is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living, right?
Yes.
Okay? So now let's look at 10, Earl's translation of 10. Why then are you pronouncing judgment upon your brother? You, why are you looking down upon your brother, right? As it happens, everyone will stand before the judgment of the seat of God. And then he quotes from Isaiah. And the passage in Isaiah, I just happen to have it here. The passage in Isaiah is from 45:23. This is what the passage says in the Hebrew text. I have sworn by myself, that's Lord speaking, the word has gone out from my mouth in righteousness and will not turn back, that to me every knee will bow, every tongue will swear allegiance. And the word, and by the way, the word allegiance isn't in the text. It literally says that to me every knee will bow and every tongue will swear. So we need to know what the word for swear is. And in, this is really interesting, because in Hebrew the word is shaba. Ah, do you hear something there? Okay, so not only is the Hebrew word to swear identical with the ancient unpointed text to the number 7, which is where Shabbat comes from, but also a relationship is suggested in 2000 BC in the Genesis 21 to 22, 22 to 34 passage. Thus, Brown Driver Briggs, BDB, has defined Shabbat by the pithy one-line phrase, to seven oneself, right? That's literally what it means. What God is saying through Isaiah is that every tongue will seven itself. And if that isn't a clear endorsement of the idea of Shabbat, I don't know what could be, because it's the same word for seven, the root for Shabbat, the root for swear. Okay, it's all about recognizing God's order in the temporal reality that we live in. Right? So what is Paul saying in this verse? It's really interesting. He quotes from Isaiah to say to these people, did you think you could come in here and practice whatever you wanted? Wrong. Right? God himself endorses the idea that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess sevening. Right? And I can see Lindy's madly looking this thing up to make sure that's true. Okay. All right. So.
No, I want to tell you that it's the end of the Elenu, the end of every single service that there is, that we say the Elenu, and that's the final line. Final line. And something in the middle of everything, my mind is going Baruch Shemo. So it's every knee will bend and every tongue will confess that his name is one.
So now this is interesting, right? Because Paul, right, when Paul's addressing Gentile believers who come into the community, right? And he's also relating them to how they're to act in front of the Orthodox. And here's his final piece of this much of the argument. Don't you realize that when you come into that community, you're under the God who says every knee, that's your knee, will bow, and every tongue, that's your tongue, will seven itself, which is an absolute endorsement of the Hebrew notion of the temporal, of God's temporal sovereignty over the week. Okay? So you can't come into this community and pretend that you can worship on Sunday. It doesn't happen. Right? That's what he's saying. And he quotes Isaiah to show that that's true. So there's no possibility that Paul can be endorsing a Christian idea of the Lord's Day as Sunday, because the very text that he uses from Isaiah makes it really clear that it has to be the seventh day, that you will swear to sevening.
That's right. So it ends with, thus it is written in your Torah, Adonai reigns forever and ever, such as the prophetic assurance. Adonai shall be acknowledged the ruler of all the earth, and on that day his name, he shall be one, and his name shall be one. And that's
before the confession. And that, and what I'm trying to point out to you is that the Greek text from Isaiah points us to the Hebrew word that is the root of Shabbat. So there's absolutely no way that anybody reading this part of this letter could ever be confused about what Paul is suggesting. Okay? That if you're going to be part of the practicing community and you're a Gentile believer who comes from a pagan environment who thinks that you're free because you're not Jewish and you have this relationship to God, Paul points out two things. One, you died to get into this community. You live in the community. Act according to the community. And the most important thing in the community, as far as the temporal existence is, you have to start practicing Shabbat. Simple as that. Okay? Of course, the church never read it like that, did it? The church read it exactly the opposite. That, you know, these poor Jews are stuck with honoring one day, but we're Christians, we're free. We can have a worship service any day of the week. Yeah. Paul's not saying that at all. Okay? Okay, so I thought we were going to get further, but we didn't.
So conundrums, Kit.
Yeah.
Conundrum.
I always think that we're going to be able to make more progress, but then I don't want to prevent you from having discussion, because the whole point of this is not for me to just lecture. It's for you to learn. So, right? All I do is raise the issues, and then you have to process them. Okay.
Well, this is important stuff.
Yeah, it's very important stuff, because now look how far we've come. We did the first 8 chapters of basically Pauline theology, all the foundation work. Then we did 9, 10, 11, all Paul's concern about his Jewish Orthodox brothers, that he wants desperately to understand that Yeshua is the promised Messiah. Now we're into the practical application, 12, 13, 14, 15, before we get to his concluding remarks. Okay, all this stuff is about, okay, so now let's get down to brass tacks. How are you going to live in the community? And he's going to speak to those who are coming in and to those who are already in. He's going to say, okay, look, here's the point. Start acting in ways that welcome each other so that you have the opportunity to manifest the kind of life that you claim. And as a result, you have standing in the community so that people will understand what you have to say. So they will appreciate what you have to say, right? And
unfortunately,
Paul knows this pretty well, because he spent years in synagogue communities trying to communicate to people his belief in Yeshua as the Messiah. And on what basis? Remember that long thing in front of Felix? I'm a Pharisee of the Pharisees from the tribe of Benjamin. I've always kept all the law. I've always kept all the Torah, the oral and the written. He goes on and on about how his background is without mark, without blame, because that's what gives him the status to say this practice that, or this belief that I have about Yeshua, it doesn't come from someplace radical. It isn't an outside new religious idea. It comes from a person who stands before you as fully endorsed by God. And he could claim the same thing that David claimed, that he's blameless in front of God. Well, you can't claim that you're blameless in front of God if you think that Yeshua is, as a outside religious deity. That's not going to happen, right? So Paul's argument to Romans is just exactly the same argument that he presents to Felix, right? Look at me and see how obedient I am to the God of Israel, and then recognize that my belief in Yeshua as the Messiah is part and parcel with that. It doesn't change any of the things about what I believe about God's, you know, instructions to me.
Paul must be so sad. Paul must be so sad right now. Because everything
yeah, I think we already see how sad he was in 9, 10, 11, where he's heartbroken that after 20 years of work, he still finds the Orthodox community, not all, of course, but he still finds people in the Orthodox community that he desperately wants them to understand the blessing of understanding who Yeshua is. And, you know, it breaks his heart not to see that. Lise, you had a comment? Well, let me pick up Lise's comment, please.
Well, if we have Paul's heart and Yeshua's heart for the Jewish community, is this calling us to embrace a community, a Jewish community, and embrace Torah, and then eventually be able to show them that our faith in Messiah is not separate from Torah observance, because we believe in the God of Israel? I mean, is that a step that would be something we should be taking?
Yeah. I'm going to let Lindy comment on that, because that is the issue over Gentiles like you and me coming into a Jewish community. I just want to make this one comment before I want Lindy to comment that. My relationship with the Jewish rabbi here in Parma is built on that kind of idea, that I came to him and said, teach me Torah, right? And he was welcoming enough to say, oh, that would be really great. Let's get together. And the more time we spend together, the more we appreciate each other as people. And only in the last 2 or 3 months has he started asking about, okay, so how come you have this, you know, what is your thing about the Gospels? That's only happened in the last 2 or 3 months after 2 years of getting together once or twice a week. Right? Because first I have to show that, and it's not fake on my behalf at all. I mean, I seriously appreciate everything that I'm learning from him through his experience in the yeshiva, because I never had it. Right? So he knows the Talmud inside and out. I desperately need that. And of course I press him all the time on, okay, so what does this mean? Where did the idea come from? And now for the first time, I mean, 2 or 3 weeks ago, without my instigating it, he said, hey, you know, there's really interesting passages in the Gemara about what it says about Jesus. Oh, where did that come from? He's, you know, we're starting to appreciate each other's different perspective. But why? Because he knows that my heart is still for the God of Israel. He knows that. I wouldn't be diligently pursuing Torah and trying to understand it if I didn't have a heart for God. And he knows that. So now I have the permission to speak about my relationship. Right? Okay, Lindy, go ahead.
Well, I think that you put it really, really, really well. And Lise, when you said in order to, get rid of the in order to, the idea is become a relationship. The idea is don't go in with an agenda. And that's a real issue, because where I used to be a long time ago, you know, there was a warning. Just for example, the JCC, we're dancers. A bunch of us dance. I used to dance. And for me, it wasn't a problem, but people would go messianic to go to the Israeli dancing at the JCC Jewish Community Center with flyers, an agenda. It's a real issue. Just go build a relationship. Don't go into a synagogue thinking you are going to fix them. Go into a synagogue and see how they work, and see how you can work and create a relationship. Learn their way. And if you can build a relationship, then maybe people will begin to understand. And there is a wall wherever you are, and especially now. There's a bigger wall now in all the what's going on in this world, and distrust of a lot of people. So it's an agenda. Yep. Agenda is a real issue. Get rid of your agenda. Get to know a person.
Let me give you some of the background about how this relationship with the rabbi in Parma started, right? First, I had to pursue it. There's no way to contact this guy. I mean, I spent over a month, emails, phone calls, all kinds of stuff, to even find him, right? And so just that effort alone meant I was seriously interested. And then basically I said, I never told him what my background is at all. I just said, listen, I want to learn Torah. Will you teach me? I mean, he was thrilled because he's got members in his own synagogue who don't ever ask that question, right? So now he has a chance to share with me his insights into Torah. And that's the only reason I went. I never went there to try to convince him of Yeshua as the Messiah. I don't care if he ever gets to that point. I'm just enjoying his relationship with God. And that's really, really blessing me. And of course, once in a while, I share with him once something that I write in Today's Word, and then he makes some comments about it, and I have to make some corrections and stuff. So he knows that there's interaction, but it's all about just enjoying each other's perspective on our experience with God. It has absolutely no agenda other than that. Right? So, and I think that's the approach.
Go ahead, Lindy. No, go ahead, Phyllis.
I was just going to say one thing. I also think it has a lot to do with how the person you're talking to, how you perceive Yeshua and how you, in regards to how the church perceives Yeshua. I mean, that's a big thing. In the way Lisa is going to understand Yeshua is going to be a lot different than just a normal person who talks about Yeshua to a Jewish person.
Yeah,
that's a big difference.
And for that, I can say that the rabbi in Parma absolutely knows that I don't believe Yeshua is God. So that starts off, you know, that levels some of the playing field for us. Okay.
Yeah. I was just going to say, and because everybody's in a different area. I don't know where your areas are. I'm in an area where you could walk into many synagogues. If you went, generally speaking, because I don't know where you are, if you walked into a synagogue for a service and you saw that the people were sitting separate, be respectful and you go and you sit to the men's side, to the women's side. Or if you were in a conservative synagogue and just watch what's going on. And then depending on the synagogue, people will come up and start talking to you. You can just say, I'm here because one, I'm curious. Two, I would like to learn. And don't bring up Yeshua or Jesus or anything at all. Just walk in and be who you are, minus that, and just see how it goes.
Yep.
Get involved in one of their classes. Again, I don't know where you are, so it's a hard thing for me to say.
But we
have a Shabbat. Ours is a Shabbat synagogue. I don't know if that.
Okay, so a Chabad, number one, you're going to be separate. Number two, you're going to sit on the women's side in there. Generally speaking, they're open and welcoming, and you can talk with them. Again, all the Chabads I know, you know, they're welcoming, but there's some, because people are people. So you could walk in and go to a service. That one's going to be in Hebrew. Where are you located?
We're in Quebec, so.
You're in where?
We're French.
Quebec.
Yeah, we're French Quebec.
Quebec.
Yeah.
That's going to be in Hebrew.
Let me tell you what I did with Chabad. I'm really thrilled about this, okay?
I love Chabad.
I got a request for a donation to Chabad, which I've done in the past. And this time I wrote back to the rabbi who's responsible for, you know, donations and all this kind of stuff. His name is Rabbi Green. And I wrote to him and I told him, you know, I really have a heart for Israel. I believe in the God of Israel, but I want to tell you about my situation. I told him all about my knee. I said, okay, maybe this is just a form email and you'll never respond. Guess what? He responded. He responded and said, oh, I'm so sorry to hear about your problems with your pain. So now we've started a correspondence and I'm writing to him and he's writing to me. And I mean, he's one of the executive guys in Chabad. So at some point, I'm going to say to him, hey, how can I get more involved? Because it's going to go that way, right? And it's not because I'm trying to convert him. It's because I want to understand the perspective of Torah that they have. That I think the real motivation can never be, I'm going to help these people see the truth. It's always got to be, they know things that I don't know, and I need to understand that. That if you go with that, you have no other agenda, I think you'll do fine.
You'll find more acceptance in a Chabad than you will in an ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah, they wouldn't even. That.
Just so you know, I mean, there's that difference because they are more outreach. And and there's a lot more joy in the Chabad services.
Yeah.
So okay, ideally,
just a second, Benita. I'm going to stop the recording, but I'm not going to close the conference. Hold on, because we don't need to record all this stuff. So hold on.